Now I call Peter Walker the number of the sorry for me.
Lawrence.
You know, I like it. His dictionary is still there, you know, what is the name of Mrs. Patcher. That's why he's on my mind. I call on Comrade Peter Lawrence to speak for the Socialist Party. Comrade is all for it.
What he meant was he thought you came here by walking.
I did a fair amount of walking a few times. Well, here's for another emotional outburst. I couldn't resist a wry sort of smile, comrades and friends, when Joe Gandhi said he wanted to keep the thing non-political, you know, because he's embarked on a really radical attempt to reform the whole structure of the world's politics. And he wants to do this to improve the lot of mankind, and at the same time he wants to keep this more or less non-political. I think he's not going to manage that.
Non-party political.
Or party political. I've read the leaflet very carefully that Joe Gandhi has issued, and I dare say you all have, and it struck me in reading it that there are two themes running through the leaflet which in Joe Gandhi's mind go together, and there are two themes, one to do with the establishment of world government, and the other is the establishment of what he calls one world. In other words, this is a world as he envisages it of complete human unity. And as I say, in his mind, the two themes of world government and one world and unity go together. And I want to say that on the face of it, I think it would be fairly reasonable for an ordinary person to look at the modern world and see the way in which it's totally divided between about 161 nation states and think, well, these are all different governments. There's a lot of tension between them and a lot of strife, and it generates an enormous arms race, creates armies of wars and all this sort of thing. So that if only we could change the political structure and not have a world where all these different governments existed, then all these problems would not flow from a world government, and you'd have a united world. I mean, I think that's a fairly reasonable response to the sort of world that you're confronted by. But what we would, I think, put to him is that he's really concentrating his mind on political structures much too separate from other important elements in life. And we would say that political structures are not in themselves primary entities, but they do in fact express national economic interests, and it is those economic factors which divide the modern world and which are the primary factor in keeping the world, as I say, divided, and that's where we ought to look at the source of the problem. If that's right, then, if we keep all the economic structures in exactly the same way as they exist now, but have some sort of radical program of political reform, then it would follow that if the so problems that we have don't come from the political structures but come from the economic structures, then the same sorts of problems would continue even in a world of one world government. The fact is that people are not generally interested in the structures of politics as things in themselves. They want to capture power or bring pressure to bear on these things for different reasons. And this theme runs through Joe Gandhi's leaflet here. He doesn't really want world government as an end in itself. What he's saying is, what ordinary human beings want is peace and unity. So those are the ultimate objectives that he's got in his mind, peace and unity. And we want to put it to him that there is a far more practical and realistic way of achieving these things, which has already begun now with the World Socialist Movement.
It's particularly unfortunate that one of the examples he gives in his leaflet of the sort of thing he's looking for is the EEC and the European Parliament, I presume. Well, we all know that this was not motivated by any move to bring unity to Europe. This was brought about by European nations and governments who thought that their economic interests could best be served by getting together on a certain number of things, putting up trade barriers around a common market between these 10 EEC countries and engaging in all sorts of mutual research and development projects, which in capitalist terms are very, very expensive. One example, of course, is the Tornado aircraft. In other words, this, you know, what is it generating, the EEC? The Tornado aircraft is one of the most sophisticated fighter planes in the modern world, which has been developed by the countries of the EEC. I think the engine is made in Britain, the fuselage is made in France, and the wings are made in Germany, or some such arrangement. And these governments have pooled their economic resources in this fantastically expensive research and development of this machinery of war. What the EEC is really about is a structure for another power block, which is in response to the power blocks of America and Russia. So what it's really, the sort of promise that it's really holding out, is war and conflict on a bigger and bigger scale, and it's not a step towards unity. The other important thing you'd say about the EEC is that if at any time any of its member states felt that it no longer served their interests, they would, of course, pull out. And it's very much on the cards that Britain might do that in the near future. There's another thing you've got to say about armies and the military. They're not simply for the purpose of fighting wars between rival states. Every capitalist arrangement would need a standing army just to keep the working class down. In other words, if you had a system of world government, the capitalists who run this world government would still have to keep a standing army in reserve for the purpose of keeping the working class down should they get out of hand, which they're very inclined to do from time to time, as you well know. For example, in this miners' strike, if things had developed in a different way, perhaps if they'd got more support for the other unions in this miners' strike, if they'd been able to completely shut down coal production and hold out on strike for long enough, run down the reserves of coal, then it would have been a question of stopping the movement of coal from the pit heads to the power stations and this sort of thing. And in these circumstances, the police up to now have been enough, more or less, to deal with the workers. But in that situation, doubtless, the government would have to bring the troops out, as they've done on many, many occasions. And, I mean, particularly the whole history of India shows that the use of the army has been mainly for the purpose of quelling what they call civil unrest. So the establishment of world government would not do away with the need for standing armies. But I don't want to deal at too great a length on the feasibility of a one-world government. I don't think it's really on. I don't think capitalists are interested in it, for a start, and I don't think workers are particularly interested in it. I really want to concentrate on the theme of unity and the realistic way in which we can try and build a world of unity. And although I would say that if we look at the world, you know, in the way we normally do, it presents itself as a very, very complicated thing. But a sensible and ordinary approach to the question of getting some sort of peace and unity for human beings in a world which presents itself as being a very, very complicated thing is to start off with very, very simple concepts And it's interesting, I think, that Joe Gandhi has already mentioned some of these himself. He says that in his experience, the common people of the world, they're the same all over. What they want is peace and that sort of thing. And that's a good starting off point to start thinking about what ordinary people actually want in their ordinary day lives. And I'd like to pick up that thread from Joe Gandhi. I mean, let's develop it a bit. And what do people want? They want a decent standard of material life, which is secure and reliable. They want decent clothing. They want decent, comfortable housing. They want all the sort of services that go with it, these sort of elementary things. They want entertainment, travel, these sorts of things. And they want to feel socially useful, that the things they do in life not only are in their own interests, but also coincide with the interests of others and enhance the lives of interest. They want a democratic voice in the running of the community's affairs. They want to feel that in all the important decisions that are made that affect them and the community, that they should have a say. These are the ordinary things that people want. Now, how do you get them? Well, again, the answer is quite straightforward, really, because all these goods and services and procedures for making decisions and this sort of thing, they rest on work. The application of all the various skills and talents and energies of useful people that exist throughout the world. You know, the work of building, of transport, work of supplying energy, work of farming, work of science and applied technology, arts and crafts, you name it, all these things in all their variety combine to provide the productive resources that are shared between ordinary people right throughout the world, as you quite rightly say. And this is the material basis on which, in a sane world, you could bring all these productive resources to bear on the ordinary needs that exist that we've also talked about. And, you know, where's the problem? Well, the real problem in this, and this is the fundamental and very, very basic factor which divides humanity. It is this. It's not primarily to do with political structures. It's to do with the fact that all these resources of energy and skill that are potential as they exist right amongst the working class, right across the world, do not have access to the productive resources by which they can provide for all the needs that exist. They don't have free access to them. They're not under their democratic control. These productive resources throughout the world are owned and controlled by a privileged minority in society, the capitalist class. It's either done privately, as in Western European capitalism or in America, or it's done through state capitalism as it exists in Russia. But whichever system you're talking about, you've got a small privileged minority who monopolise and control the productive resources of life, the systems of transport, the sources of energy, manufacturing, mining, industry, the whole lot. So the source of the division that exists in the world is this division between potential useful labour and its lack of access. It's separated from the productive resources because they are owned and controlled by a privileged minority. Now, it doesn't matter how you reform the political structure. If you leave that fundamental divisive feature that characterises modern world society intact, you will always have a disunited world, and you will always have a world that is riven with strife and conflict, because it generates enormous struggle. Because in a capitalist society, the whole object of production is not to produce useful things for human needs, it's to produce commodities on the markets for sale at a profit. That's the whole object of the thing. And workers, useful workers, only get access to the means of production, only get a job and are employed, on condition that they make profit for those who own and control the means of production. Now, that's what we would argue is the central and fundamental problem which is at the basis of this whole problem of world unity. Because what it amounts to is this, that capitalist nations are divided within themselves, and there's a mass of evidence about that. You know, you can't pick up the newspaper or see the TV news without seeing talk of industrial conflict. So our society is riven by conflict within nations, and then, of course, as we all know, it's riven by conflict between nations because all these capitalist economic entities, nations run by the governments, are all in rivalry and conflict with each other. Now, we've said that it's not a question of politics as such, it's a question of economic interests. And this is what I think, to get the sort of world that you want and the sort of world that we want, that we've got to pick up on. Which interest is it that exists now that has the capability in its fullest expression of building a united world? Well, the interest is of ordinary working people. And their common interest right throughout the world is to get control of the means of production, so on that basis they can then, through cooperation, combine to produce all the things that they need. Now, that is the economic interest that we are working with, and it is the only one, I would say, which has a realistic prospect of establishing a world of unity and accord between the world's people. I don't want to go on too long because I'm sure a lot of other people want to get in on the discussion, but I would like to say this. I can put it to him that the kind of world administration that he would like to see all established actually already exists in embryo form in the socialist movement. We've got companion parties in various countries. I say embryo because they are in fact very, very tiny indeed, but nevertheless they do exist. And our party is totally democratic in its structure. It is completely and utterly in control, under the control of all its members. We've got no leaders, and we've got no policy-making executive committees, all right about that. So the whole administration of the party is democratic. And it is linked democratically with associated companion parties in other parts of the world. Now, brought to its full fruition, this embryo form of democratic administration, once it gets a majority of supporters of workers throughout the world, and once it expresses that through taking over the whole machinery of governments and enacting common ownership of the means of production, we'll be able to translate these democratic traditions into the democratic running of the whole of society. So we're aiming then at two things: the common ownership of the means of production, preceded by not the restructuring of governments. I'm astonished, actually, that Joe Gandhi should be taken up with governments. I would have thought this was the time for thinking, for Christ's sake, let's get rid of them. I mean, the modern world, as I think he did suggest, has been the result, partly at least, of the policies of governments. Now's the time to think not in terms of bigger and better governments, but getting rid of them altogether, because we don't need them, they're completely redundant. What do we want governments for anyway? We can have a world system of democratic administration without electing people in position of the control of the state to impose their decisions on the rest of the community. You just don't need it in a rational society based on equality. So that's what we're working for. When we speak of taking over the whole machinery of governments, which we've said in our principles, and doubtless you've had a look at them, what we mean by that is that both at the local level and national level, we shall take over the whole structures and machinery of governments and convert these into the democratic administration of society. And then, as well as these local and regional levels, we would have democratic organisation at a world level. And the whole function of these three different spheres of democratic administration would be to organise and coordinate world cooperation to produce goods and services directly for human needs. Now, it's in these circumstances where you can get rid of government, where you can get rid of armies, all the allocations of labour that are spent uselessly on the arms race and standing armies and all the rest of it, and not only those, but all the other wasteful features of capitalism. In other words, you'll be able to divert all the labour and energy that presently goes into all these wasteful activities directly for human need. So that's the barrier that we've got to break. The barrier that exists between potentially useful labour and using that labour for needs. That barrier is the fact that it's separated and divorced from the productive resources. We've got to bring these three elements together in a sane society, and that's how you're going to bring about a world of unity that both you want and we want.
Thanks, Comrade Peter Lawrence. The next thing is collection. Please give us as much as you can. You have to abolish money, but you have to collect it.
Well, I don't think we can abolish money. Can I speak out for 5 minutes to...
Yeah. You'll have time, you know, when we sum up. By the way, may I bring to the attention of our visitors, we have a listing name. Anyone wants to know about our activity in future, may put his or her name on our list.
No, thanks. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. No, I don't need to show it. No, I just have to just feel like the IOG or IOG. Thanks.
Well, comrades and visitors, we may rest for 3 minutes. During these 3 minutes, anyone want to go out to buy a drink or to do anything, he or she can. After these 3 minutes, we are going into discussion about all the matter.
Did you find it all right getting here, Joe?
Sorry?
Did you get here all right? You found...
Oh, yes, there was no problem.
I got hopelessly lost. I really did.
You mean the first time that you...
Yes,
here?
First time I've been here.
We used to meet at another class.
Oh, I see. No, I had no problem because I knew King's Cross.
Oh, wow.
And I actually, my friend and I, we came and we parked the car there.
Oh.
And we walked to the bus.
Okay.
And we were here at 7:30. Because I thought that I have difficulty in finding, so that didn't happen.